Yeah, 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 come and take a look at the snow. Bright white as far as your eyesight goes. Come and take a look at the fields of snow. I'll just get my coat, then we're good to go. Come and take a look at the lake. Let's have a quick skate before it gets late. Come and take a look at the frozen lake. Put your clothes on, mate, don't make that mistake. Ba-ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Happy Christmas.
Greetings, holiday shoppers. There are now just 126 shopping days left until Christmas, and I think you know what that means. That means it's time for another episode of Christmas Creeps, your one-stop shop for holiday madness all year round. Hi, my name is Joseph Wade. I will be your host for this evening. Here with me tonight is my co-host, Johnny Five, the human robot.
Hello, hello.
Hello, John. Mr. Bradford is once again away on clown business, and he cannot join us this week, but we have a very special guest in the studio tonight, all the way from Hollywood, California, film critic, podcaster, and cinematic renaissance man, Alonzo Duralde.
Hello.
Hi, Alonzo. How are you doing today?
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
All right. Absolutely. So we have you on the show tonight because you literally wrote the book on Christmas movies.
It's true.
Your book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. I've got a copy right here. It's great. I love it.
Oh, thank you.
I hate to admit it. It is now becoming kind of a blueprint for whatever episodes we're getting ready to embark on next.
That I am exceedingly touched to hear that. You have no idea. Weirdly enough, a good friend of mine who's also a podcaster, William Bibbiani, a couple years ago was like, oh, you should do a year-round podcast about Christmas movies. And I thought, that's crazy. Who would do such a thing? And now I have my answer, and y'all are doing a great job.
Oh, well, we appreciate that. Yeah, when I found out that you were, I guess, Mr. Christmas Movie, like, and that you followed us, I was over the moon. Like, that's a huge honor as far as I'm concerned. But when we talked to you, we let you decide what movie we were going to be discussing in this week's episode, and you chose 1985's The Sure Thing from director Rob Reiner. Mm-hmm. Real quick, tell us a little bit about your history with this film.
I saw this movie. Well, I mean, I suspect a touch older than you guys. So I was in college when it came out. I saw it when it was new in theaters. Okay. And, you know, Rob Reiner at the time was just coming off of This Is Spinal Tap. So mm-hmm. everybody was very excited to see what he was going to be doing next. And, you know, he had this cast of fresh-faced newcomers. You know, I had spotted John Cusack as sort of a bit player in, you know, 16 Candles and a few other things, but this was really his first big starring role. Had never seen Daphne Zuniga before, or Nicolette Sheridan, or, you know, Anthony Edwards, I guess, if you were really keeping your eyes peeled during Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But for the most part, these were all, like, you know, new faces. And this was a really kind of charming road picture. You know, we were deep into the John Hughes section of the decade, and this movie felt like it was a little smarter, a little more realistic, a little more emotionally truthful, I guess.
Yeah, I'm going to admit I had not seen this film before we agreed to discuss it. So it was brand new for me, and I found myself really enjoying it. Like, it's not what you imagine like an 80s teen sex comedy would be. It kind of zigs where a lot of those others ones would zag.
Yeah, and you see Nicolette Sheridan in that bikini on the poster, and you think it's going to be like Hard Bodies or something.
Right, exactly. That first scene of her just laying out on the beach, and like, she's the sure thing, and it's just, okay, this is what the movie's going to be. And then it takes a hard left turn, and we'll get into it in a bit. That's not at all what the film is.
Totally.
So I guess I want to back up just for a moment because we have you on as a guest, and we want to chat with you a little bit.
Please.
What is your history with Christmas movies in general?
Well, you know, I have been obsessed with movies my whole life, and I've been a big fan of Christmas, I guess, my whole life as well. So, you know, ultimately those two paths were going to converge in a wood somewhere in the snow. and then also, I've been working for newspapers since about 1988. Or so, as a, you know, professional, as a college graduate, and invariably, you know, the internet obviously has taken the listicle to a whole new place. But even back then, I would get asked by editors every year around Christmas time, oh, come up with a list of alternative Christmas movies or movies that people don't think of as Christmas movies or whatever. And I had made enough of those lists and had sort of cataloged enough of these kind of like, hey, Less Than Zero, you know, Die Hard, Eyes Wide Shut, whatever sort of odd choices over the years, that I eventually thought maybe there's a book in this. And whether or not there was, I wrote one.
All right, so it is definitely kind of an encyclopedia of movies either that are about Christmas or that feature Christmas or even tangentially related to the holidays. And I feel like The Sure Thing kind of falls into that latter category because this is not necessarily a holiday film, but it plays with the trappings of Christmas and the holidays in a couple of interesting ways.
Yeah, in looking at it again, I was like, okay, this is really Christmas as sort of a ticking clock device. Maybe it needed to be winter to sort of, you know, be part of the challenge of the road trip or whatever. But yeah, this is not, swathed in holly or anything.
Right, right. I think Christmas is sort of a good excuse to get them on the road because, you know, you've got your college students, and when do college students have time off? Well, they've got a good, you know, 2-3 weeks in the middle of, the school year.
Exactly.
Whatever. So made sense.
You could probably tweak this into being a spring break movie if you felt like it, but, you know.
Right.
Feel weird having them spend 3 days on the road to spend like 1 day and then have to go back another 3 days on the road. But
this is true.
That might make for an even more interesting film, though, because, oh, my God, we have to get back to school in 3 days. But
we have to have sex really fast.
Yeah. Well, and we're teenagers, so that's going to happen regardless. All right. So I'm going to ask Johnny Five now to please. We started doing this thing again where we try to recap the plot in 5 minutes or less. Ooh. I'm going to ask Johnny Five to do that because I think that would be fun.
All right. It's a sex drive with no Clark Duke and no social media.
Oh, my God, he did it.
Wow.
Oh, man. Care to elaborate?
Man, not really, but I will. John Cusack is playing John Cusack, and Daphne Zuniga, who is Princess Vespa, is literally the only other thing I've seen her in, is a bookworm, pretty much. That's the character type we're going to go with here.
Yeah, yeah. He's wacky and she's not.
Yeah, he is a slob and she is a snob.
Yeah.
And they don't get along and he hits on her. It doesn't go anywhere. He gets a call from his best friend, who is the second nerd in Revenge of the Nerds, Anthony Edwards, who moved to California for class. And he's like, hey, you should come out here. I know this girl who really wants to fuck, and she's agreed to fuck you. It's weird. It's not really a thing of, oh, I told her all about you. You know, she really likes you. It's more just like, hey, I know this slutty chick, is pretty much what it comes off as. Because
I showed her your picture, and I'm going to send you her picture. Hey, let's make this happen.
Yeah, it really doesn't seem like he kind of goes into a little bit of like, she's into you. It's more just like, hey, I know someone who will even fuck you, basically.
It's kind of sad, yeah.
So he agrees to go out. He ends up ride sharing with Tim Robbins, and because this is a movie, Daphne Zuniga Allison ends up in the same car. They bicker and fight enough to annoy Tim Robbins. He kicks them out. Some wacky road trip adventures happen. They bond basically just out of being forced into like proximity to each other, more or less.
Yeah, yeah.
She loosens him up a bit. He falls in love with her because what else is he going to do in this movie? They get out to California. She goes with her boyfriend, who that's the reason she was coming out there. She realizes he's kind of weird and stuffed up and frumpy, and she doesn't like him that much anymore.
Her 35-year-old college-aged boyfriend.
Yeah. They fight about something. They go back to class, and then they make up and kiss, and then the movie ends. Right. And the Eagles happen somewhere in the middle there, and it was really annoying.
Yeah, Heartache Tonight. That's kind of the if there was any one song that sort of typifies this movie, it's Heartache Tonight, I think.
the song choices are not necessarily on the nose in that like Suicide Squad way, and that they're, you know, to always underscoring what's happening, but they are like the super basic jukebox hits of the 70s and 80s.
Definitely. Like, and I think the most on the nose this movie gets with its soundtrack choices is in a road trip. At the beginning of this road trip comedy, they pick the Huey Lewis song where he just names cities.
Oh, good point. I hadn't thought about that.
It's so like, these are all the cities we're not going to see on this road trip.
Yeah, it was really weird for being a road trip movie. They were very Anytown USA about the entire thing. I think UCLA is the only definite location they ever bother mentioning.
Yeah, it's not uncommon, I've discovered over the years, for road pictures to be shot entirely in California. Like Greg Araki's The Living End is sort of infamous for this. There's one shot of a Austin, Texas highway sign that apparently Richard Linklater ran out and filmed for him on 16 millimeter and sent to him. But yeah, for the most part, it's all pretty much in California. And this one, I think, was mostly shot in Stockton, which is kind of, you know, somewhat anonymously agricultural, I guess. And so I think that's what a lot of the settings wound up being. I want to give a shout out to Lisa Jane Persky, who plays Tim Robbins's like co-driver. She most famous probably for the film The Great Santini, but she also pops up in Reiner's When Harry Met Sally and is a fun character actress I like a lot.
That's where I've seen her before. I knew she looked familiar, but I couldn't place it. When Harry Met Sally, yeah. But yeah, and also I also know that they filmed part of this in Cornell University because they needed like a school setting, like an Ivy League setting in the snow. Yep. So there's like one shot of John Cusack running across the quad in the snow. And it's like, we got Cornell.
They intentionally filmed on a bunch of different campuses so you couldn't pin it down to one. It was just generic Ivy League.
The Hallmark Channel has made me very attuned to weather in these movies. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's like there's a couple snowy campus shots, like sort of bracketing the Christmas break part of the movie.
Right.
But beyond that, it's just sort of like, well, they're wearing coats, but who knows?
It looks cold. That's about as good as we can get. But yeah, I think you made a good point there. Like it is very every town USA. Like the most you see on the road is like truck stops and motels, and that's a bar somewhere. That's about it. You don't know exactly where they are on their journey. You just know that they're still on their journey. And once they kind of get to Los Angeles, you can really tell.
Johnny, did you really want a shot of them like driving by the St. Louis Arch or something? Or
I was coming off of like, you know, things like Vacation, so I kind of more expected that.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it kind of goes, you go from cows to scrubland. That's how you kind of get an idea of the progress they're making.
No, I was going to say, and it's not snowing anywhere, of course.
Once they leave Gibbs College, the snow is just gone from the picture. Yeah, exactly. I like that they at least included, you know, features like late in their journey, you can tell they're kind of in the desert, like West Texas or someplace. So you can kind of sort of plot the journey along if you're really paying attention. But for the most part, it's a fairly anonymous sort of road trip across America. Which I guess if you've driven across America, you kind of know that's sort of what the heartland kind of looks like anyway.
True. I think this movie really lives and dies by the dialogue and the chemistry, which I think it succeeds at both. I think that Cusack and Daphne Zuniga have a real spark to them. They, you know, yeah, they are basically he's a slob and she's uptight, and they manage to meet in the middle in a sort of classic screwball kind of way. A lot of critics compared this movie to It Happened One Night when it came out, and I don't think that's a completely, you know, bananas comparison. They, you know, they're really charming, and there's some funny dialogue, and I think the movie never turns her into such a prig, you know, that it's kind of punching down at her. And even the girl who's the sure thing, I mean, they're just skating on the edge of, you know, agency and things. But they, I think, at least give her a little bit of credit in terms of there's a line about how she just got released from Catholic school and she's, you know, going wild. And so, you know, the movie is never like, ew, you know, slut. I think it's more like, hey, she's in her slutty phase. Let's, you know, let's strike while the iron is hot. I don't know. I'm sure there are differing takes on it, but in watching it again, that was my biggest concern sitting down this weekend to watch. I was like, oh, is she going to be treated like the town pump or something? And it's like, no, they, you know, you could walk away from this not thinking of her as merely a sex object.
Right. And that's kind of the way they marketed the film, and the way the DVD cover is, it's just Nicolette Sheridan on the beach. And you kind of get the idea that, oh, this is definitely what this is going to be about. And in the age of, like, you know, Me Too and all the, you know, sexual allegations that are going around, like this, I was kind of worried that this film would not play well. But then it turned out to be much more thoughtful than you kind of expect it to be, because it's about the fact that the sure thing is maybe not the right thing.
Exactly. And once we meet her, like, she seems sweet and she has, you know, thoughts. It's not like she's just this complete brainless bimbo. But yeah, the movie obviously is cheerleading for for romance over, like, you know, an anonymous quickie.
I don't want to say it, but I'm going to say it. It doesn't slut shame her at all either. It's like, you know, this would be fine too, but this is not really what he wants at this point in his life either.
Yeah, I don't think the movie is punishing her or judging her in any way.
Yeah, exactly. It's very sort of what's the right word?
It doesn't come across until the end, but yeah, at the end, she is more going up to Anthony Edwards and being like, is this the guy you've been telling me about? Rather than just be like, is this the thing I'm fucking? So that's refreshing, because right. Up to the lead up to it, it just seems like Anthony Edwards is just like, I found something for you to stick your dick in.
And yeah, I was wondering whether or not, like, at the end she was going to show up and she was going to say something like, is this the guy you paid me to see? Or, you know, something along those lines.
But yeah, because no, we don't really hear from her until that point of the film either. Like,
exactly.
She only exists as a photograph and then within John Cusack's fantasies. So
right, she's the literal dream girl.
Exactly.
And I think one of the more clever instances of the film is, like, every time they stop at a motel or someplace overnight and they go to bed, and either Gib and Allison, those are the characters' names, either Gib and Allison are fighting over who's going to sleep in the bed, who's going to sleep on the floor. Once that's over and done with, we always see kind of what Gib dreams about, and it's always the dream girl in the Malibu beach house. And either she's after him to, you know, to go to bed with her one more time, because she just loves him that much, she just needs to have him that much. And then later in the film, he has that same dream, but then all of a sudden, oh no, it's Allison, and this right. is, Allison is suddenly his dream girl, and it kind of takes a turn, and it plays it very well. Like, I'm consistently impressed with the way this script kind of builds up the relationship, because it kind of does it incrementally, very slowly. It doesn't hit you over the head with it, but it really works.
Yeah, I think they're convincing as a couple who don't like each other, and they're convincing as a couple who do.
Right. It's not a thing where he sort of turns her kind of onto his side on a dime. Like, he has to really work at it, and he has to work not just to make her fall in love with him, but just to make her like him and to just want to be in his presence even a little bit. Because, yeah, it starts out and she really does kind of hate him, and he has to do the work of being a decent person to her over the course of the film. It's
at the same time, he's not necessarily trying to win her over either, which is nice. It's more just a thing that happens. Like, he's not like, oh, I have to make her like me. It's just, he more just stops being such a shithead to her.
Exactly. He's trying to win her over because they're stuck on this road trip together, and it's either win her over so that she likes me for the rest of this road trip, or have a road trip with a person who hates my guts.
Right.
Yeah. So we talked about what makes this a Christmas movie, and it's kind of not, but it deals with the accoutrements of the holidays. Like, we see a truck stop that's decorated with, you know, Christmas lights, and it's got a Santa on top and stuff like that. We don't really get a whole lot of, like, holiday music in the film. There's one really great scene, though.
I was just going to say, there is an exception.
So tell us about that scene real quick.
So once it's clear that, like, she could have gotten, there's a point where she could get on the bus and go to California with Adam. He can't afford it, and she decides to stay and hitchhike with him, which is sort of the first inclination that they're beginning to warm up towards each other.
Right.
And so they're in a motel room. He's trying to teach her how to shotgun a beer. There's kind of a romantic spark there, but he realizes that she's got a boyfriend and he's kind of afraid of it. So he decides to take off and go to the nearby bar. And, you know, he's a college freshman, so his fake ID is like Dr. Abramowitz or something. But he winds up, like, buying drinks for these two other sort of, like, you know, kind of drunk dudes who are at the bar. And at some point, one of them starts singing Mel Torme's The Christmas Song. And Cusack joins in, and then this other lanky dude at the end of the bar joins in, and suddenly there's this, like, lovely kind of three-part harmony happening. You know, Jack Frost nipping at your nose. It's a funny scene.
I was really disappointed when the scene cut, like, in the middle of a verse, because I wanted to hear the whole song. They were doing so well at it, and I want a full version of that song. It's got to exist out there somewhere.
It should be an outtake on the Blu-ray for sure.
It really should, yeah. Like, every Christmas when you see, like, channels like MTV Classic or whatever do, like, blocks of Christmas music videos, I want to see this scene.
That cut between that scene and the next was really weird to me, because it cuts from him just being absolutely blasted singing to just him the next day looking none worse for the wear, just being like, come on, come on, we're going to be late, we have to go now.
When you're a college freshman, you bounce back faster,
I guess.
You develop a tolerance very quickly. Oh, man.
And that's actually when he comes back to the hotel room, he collapses on the bed and she puts the blanket on him and then goes to sleep on the floor. So technically, she always gets stuck on the floor until finally she allows him to platonically share her bed.
Right. And then the next morning, he's like draped himself over her, not like in a sexual way, but just because that's what happens when you sleep, basically.
Yeah.
You know,
you roll into each other.
Yeah, exactly. So next thing I want to talk about is, if this film is about anything, I think it's about just the general allure of California. Because the first thing that happens in the film is that, you know, they graduate, Gibb and his friend Lance graduate high school, and Lance goes off to UCLA. And the next time we see Lance, I mean, he's Anthony Edwards. He's known for, at this point, Revenge of the Nerds. The next time we see Anthony Edwards, he is Mr. Cool Guy on campus. And I have to wonder if what the film is saying is that California just magically turns dorks like me into like the new hotness. Alonso, you live in California. Is this true?
It is. When you cross the state line, they hand you a brochure and some bitchin' board shorts, and your life is transformed.
Excellent.
Yeah, Anthony Edwards in this movie is wearing some like combinations of sort of OP fashion, you know, trunks with like really painful like mid 80s Japanese inspired sleeveless tees with, you know, this was back when like the idea of a cordless phone held romance.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's I love those like very thin shades that he's got on. Like those were the style in the 80s.
Yeah, I bet they were Varnays.
Oh yeah, okay. But like the last time you see him in the movie, he's decked out in Hawaiian wear, like Hawaiian shirt, fakes, you know, hula skirt. He's got all kinds of stuff going on with like it's a Tahitian Christmas party at the school. Have a Tahitian Christmas.
I don't know if you guys watched any of the extras on the DVD, but they talked to the costume designer and they said that they couldn't really afford to dress that party. So what they did was they had a costume contest and like had prizes for like the top two or three prize winners. So they got all these college students to show up in their own like beachy, tiki, Tahitian regalia so they didn't have to do it themselves.
Oh, that's perfect. Just make the college students work for you. That's the dream.
Yes. You want to be in a movie?
Free
make
labor.
It happen.
And I'm sure people flocked to that set. Not just because it was a movie, but also because, hey, it's a party. Who doesn't love a good party? Who doesn't love a good Tahitian Christmas party?
I was going to say, I'm sure there was no prop booze on that set. Let's just put it
No. And you get that one shot of Anthony Edwards just dumping two bottles into a punch bowl. And like, that's real. Like, he's dumping it on himself. He's like, he's having a good time.
I love how the two parties we see in this movie both don't strike me as like parties people would organically have. Because there's that one, and then the first one is a bunch of high school kids have put cars all facing each other in a circle with the headlights on and are just like sock hopping in the middle of it, basically.
I mean, that's the kind of party you see in like, you know, small town America. That's what happens.
I was about to say, this is like American Graffiti bullshit.
But just put the parking lights on, not the brights. It makes all the difference.
Right. That way we can light the film properly too. Like, just exactly. Light it with cars.
I don't know if they spelled it out, but are they supposed to be just from like some other random like Midwestern bullshit town in the beginning? Because it sounds like they're both going away to college. It's not that like, oh, I'm going to Cornell down the street or anything like that.
Yeah, I think the idea is at the beginning they're in Peoria or wherever, so that one going to California and one going to New England is a big deal.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Cusack, interestingly enough, as much as his character drinks in this film, was not even 18 when they cast him, but they were such fans of his audition and stuff that they went with it. And actually, I think Roger Birnbaum, who's the producer of the film, had to sort of legally adopt him or something.
Oh my God.
Basically to like so that he could be of age to work full days and not have to have like, you know, a on-set tutor and all that stuff.
So when he's shotgunning these beers, I have to wonder, are those real beers or are they fake props?
I'm hoping not, but you know, you'd have to ask Rob Reiner.
Well, thing I read on the internet was that the shotgunning beers was included in the script because John Cusack told Rob Reiner he knew how to do that.
Oh, funny. But he may well have, you know. I don't think we all started magically drinking on our 21st birthday, you know.
No, yeah. At that point, you're an old pro at it. But, you know, for a $4 million movie, I kind of wonder, do they just go down to the corner store and get a six-pack and say, here you go? Probably.
Could be, or they're just well masked 7-ups. You never know.
That's true. So, I mean, the meta story of The Sure Thing is sort of the secret delinquency of a minor,
exactly,
on film. Oh boy.
Yeah, indeed. Because you know, if they did have sex, that would technically be, I don't know.
Yeah.
You can... How old is she exactly?
She was like 23 or 24 when they filmed this.
Oh, the actress, yeah. But the character, yeah. I'm assuming she's also a college freshman. I guess that puts them on an equal footing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's. As far as that goes, that's fine.
The other kind of interesting connections here is that, you know, Reiner, this was his second movie. So at that point, he was really still best known for having been Meathead on All in the Family.
Right.
And the executive producer of the film is Henry Winkler, who at that point was still best known for being the Fonz on Happy Days. And one of the other college students, I think, in the touch football scene is played by a guy named John Putch, who is now a prolific film and TV director, but is also the son of Jean Stapleton, who played Rob Reiner's mother-in-law on All in the Family.
Oh, wow. That's some nice connections going on here. also, I noticed in the credits, Steve Pink plays one of the football players who would then go on.
Mention that.
Yeah, who would then go on to write Gross Point Blank with John Cusack and then do the Hot Tub Time Machine movies. One exactly. of them with John Cusack. And then Cusack said, second one, no thank you, I'm out.
Yeah, favor repaid.
Absolutely. Well, we kind of sped through all my discussion topics here.
one thing is comparison. When I went into this, I was comparing it to Sex Drive because it was basically the same plot as Sex Drive. But watching it, it more ended up being that fucking JTT movie we watched, I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Oh, it ouch.
More reminded me of that in terms of a bunch of different ways of just like...
I mean, structurally, if not like, you know...
Not quality or thematically, but just like the structure, yeah.
The makers of that movie definitely watched this movie and took a lot of notes.
Right, yeah. And instead of The Sure Thing being, you know, a hot, sexy girl on a California beach, The Sure Thing is a car.
Right.
Just Gary Cole's crap-ass Camaro or whatever it was.
Talk about objectification.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just the only thing that film has over The Sure Thing is there's no scene in which John Cusack has to race a bunch of Santa Clauses. I feel like if this movie had that scene, it would have put it over the top to, like, one of my favorite films ever.
Yeah, this movie, not that a comedy needs to be longer than, like, 95 minutes, but this movie really could have used some more Christmas shenanigans, and I think it would not have suffered for it. I mean, we are 28 minutes into this movie before the road trip even starts.
Yeah.
Right, but again, I think they've got to establish those characters. Like, we have to totally know their relationship before they get in the car, or none of this works.
That's true.
Like, as tight as this movie is, it really does sort of take its time establishing everything we need to know before the actual adventure of the film gets underway. Like, we really need to understand why Allison is no big fan of Gibbs. And we need to understand why Gibb is sort of taken with Allison.
Yeah, I think a lot of movies now would be very itchy to, like, hey, get him on the road already. And this is sort of a testament to, like, well, no, let's not immediately get on the road because... They, you know, if their clash is going to mean anything, it has to come from a place, and we have to show where that place is.
Can you imagine a version of this film that begins kind of in media res, like they're on the road and in the back of Tim Robbins' car? Like, what the first scene of that film would be?
An immediate flashback, I think.
It's one of those like, yep, this is me. I bet you're wondering how I got in this situation. Let's flash back, and then the first 30 minutes of the film just play.
It all started on the first day of our English class.
My thought would more be they get in the car and they're arguing, and they just tell, don't show the relationship to Tim Robbins, basically. That's about the only way you could cut most of that out. I mean, you could shorten it down to like 15 minutes maybe, but not much shorter than that, really, to even have this have any meaning.
Even in the film that we watched, like the way they get into Tim Robbins' car is it's very quick. Like he goes to the school like bulletin board, like someone's got a listing up for passengers available, and they're on the way. Like I look down and I can look back up, and all of a sudden they're in a car, and I had to rewind the film and go, wait, what's going on?
Well, you know, that's thank you, French New Wave. You can just cut out all that stuff in the middle you don't really need, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Just jump cut straight to
the thing on the bulletin board, go to the car. We know what's happening.
Like jump cut straight to Tim Robbins singing show tunes. Like we just get right to the point. so another interesting thing about this film is that it's very concerned with sort of, I guess, the writerly approach to storytelling, because The first scene in the film, last scene in the film, they're in a college writing class. And the teacher is sort of trying to impress upon them that the best way to write about, to write what you know and write about life is to experience life. And that way you'll know exactly how to write about it, which is kind of what gets them on the journey and what brings it back around to Gibb at the end, writing his story about the sure thing and why his experiences over the course of the film kind of lead him to wanting to be with Allison instead. But something about the framing it as like starting off in a writing class feels very
contrived.
Yes, exactly. I didn't want to say like I'm very metatextual, but very contrived. Yeah, because it feels like something that a writer would do.
Well, but I think it also it does at least give them a reason to occupy the same space when they have like no friends in common or no social reason to do so. It also gives him an excuse to reach out to her, which is, hey, I'm failing this class. Can you help me?
Right.
So, I mean, yes, but I think they at least fit it in the context of the film and who these characters are to make it not so glaringly a, hey, this is an exercise in living one's life to then write about it. You know,
actually, you know what? You're right. Because now that I think about it, if this had been like a history class, there would be no reason at the end for him to like write out an essay about what he learned over the course of the film. It's like, exactly. you can't come back after Christmas break and take a history exam about, you know, the War of 1812, and then all of a sudden like write your love to Allison in the test answers. That doesn't make sense.
I want to mention the creative writing teacher is played by the great Vivica Lindfors, who was a Swedish actress who came to the States, I think, in the late 40s. Warner Brothers sort of thought she was going to be the new Garbo or something. Did not have the most sterling career, but then did a lot of stage work, and then later on became this really great character actress in films like this. And she did several Henry Jaglom movies, and she's in Creepshow. You know, she had a really fascinating career,
and she's great in this film too. Like, she really makes a meal out of that scene where she's reading off Gibb's essay about how to the right way to eat pizza.
And just her whole like her list of admonitions about, like, you know, eat food that is bad for you, make love in a hammock, like, that's you want an actress who's going to really like Karen Black it up, you know. I think Vivica Lindfors is having a hoot with that, and they dress her constantly in this sort of like bohemian, I'm stuck in this college town, but damn it, I'm gonna let people know that I lived in Paris for a while, you know.
She's every English teacher I've ever had. And I say that with all love and respect, because like it's a perfect sort of character. She really nails it. As well as in the scene where Gibb accidentally turns in his roommate's hustler letter, and she reads it to the
penthouse forum, I believe,
to his absolute horror and shock. But like she
I'm really a freshman at a small Midwestern university.
It's great. But again, going back to just the structure of just of this being a classroom, the prompt for that assignment was basically just write a paper. I don't care what the prompt is. Write a paper and let's see what happens. I would love to have taken that class.
I think there are creative writing classes where they sort of start you off with like just describe a thing, or, you know, like explain a thing, or like they'll be pretty vague about it, and then later they start hammering down into the more specific, like, you know, what they want you to write about.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I remember like freshman comp, the first assignment was just write a personal narrative. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as it was I completely made up a fucking bullshit story because I couldn't think of anything, so I just made up a story that fit the rubric, and it worked. Like, they don't
and
care.
Did you learn that you had to live life and write about it?
No, I learned that I could just lie and still get a grade.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I had that comp 101 class, and it was like, go to a place, observe the people there, and write about your experience there. So I went to, I went down to the beach, went onto the pier late at night, because there's like a whole like community of like night fishermen down at the beach there. And I just sat there and watched the night fishermen for like half an hour and wrote a paper about it. So
I went to the park and wrote about squirrels.
Well, you know, we can't all go to school at the beach, I guess.
Malibu U,
yeah. Oh my god. So yeah, we've I think we've man, we really sped through this film. I don't have much else I want to address.
Except, yeah, there's not a lot to crap on here, you know. But again, there's also not a lot of Christmas. You're right.
Right. Well, it's sort of a double-edged sword here, because on the one hand, like, yeah, we don't have a whole lot to discuss as far as Christmas goes, but on the other hand, man, I'm surprised that I really enjoyed this film. I'm glad I watched it.
I was just going off of face value of just like, okay, it's Meathead doing a John Cusack slob versus snob fall in love movie. Like, everything about that just sounds like I just want to roll my eyes across the damn floor. But it's...
we have to remember, when this came out, nobody knew who John Cusack was. And Rob Reiner, like, this is that golden period where he was just cranking out the hits.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this, Spinal Tap, you know, Stand By Me, When Harry Met Sally. Like, The Princess Bride. He just had this period where, like, it was just one great thing after another. And we have not returned to that period, unfortunately.
No, I think after Misery, I guess, it's all been a little bit...
I'll give him American President. I think that was the last one.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good one. He had a film out recently, didn't he?
He had a couple. He had there was the LBJ movie with Woody Harrelson, and then there was the one with James Marsden and Woody Harrelson about the Knight Ridder reporters who questioned the run-up to the Iraq War or something.
Mm-hmm. Shock and awe. But, yeah, I remember seeing about that film. I haven't seen it, but yeah.
Yeah, the reviews were not encouraging.
Right.
But they were better than the ones for, like, that one with Morgan Freeman, the something with an island in the title. I don't remember. But, yeah, he still works, but it's just been a while since it's been like, hey, there's a Rob Reiner movie.
Right. It's not, you don't get excited about it like you used to, which is kind of a shame.
Exactly. Yeah.
But, yeah, absolutely. The Sure Thing, it's not much of a Christmas film. I won't know that I would watch it around the holidays, but, you know, I'm glad we watched it here in the summer when it's, like, it's this prime road trip season, and it kind of fits. That's kind of why I think that's why we picked it for this week's episode, because we're kind of in the prime road trip, like, weeks here, right before, like, school gets back into session and late summer. Like, this is the time you want to hit the road. And yeah, The Sure Thing is definitely one of the better road trip comedies of the 80s. My DVD here, the critic quote here says, "This film gets my unapologetic nomination for the greatest film ever made," in all caps. I don't know that I'd go that far, but...
that's heavy.
It's a little much, but if you're trying to sell a DVD, that's a pretty good one to go with.
Okay, yeah, I was just looking just to be out of curiosity. Yeah, it was released in March of 85.
Okay.
So yeah, it was not, and Christmas seems to be more as like, why would they be away from school for a couple of weeks? Yeah, Christmas, whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's definitely a very plot device Christmas.
Right. But still, you know, it's not one to sleep on, I think. It's not one that's well remembered now, I think, but it's well worth seeking out.
Yeah, it has kind of gotten lost in the shuffle, but I think it's one of those ones like Say Anything where... It maybe stands apart from the pack of 80s teen movies a little, and might be worth, you know, a little celebration.
Right. Stands maybe head and shoulders above, like, other Cusack comedies like Better Off Dead or One Crazy Summer.
Speaking of which, sure. I was kind of disappointed. It's like Cusack 80s movie and I didn't get an animated intro. That made me sad.
They hadn't ironed out all the tropes yet.
Right. Like, 80s Christmas movie and there's no animated intro? What the hell?
Have y'all done Better Off Dead yet?
Is that a Christmas movie?
Oh, hell yeah, it's a Christmas movie.
How did I not know this? Yeah, I think we're going to have that to the list.
David Ogden Stiers wearing a reindeer coat and, you know, the do you celebrate Christmas in France, lady? I mean, oh, it's very much a Christmas movie.
Well, I hate to admit it, but I'm leafing through your book right here. And
I was just going to say, I thought you read my book.
I'm looking at the index of titles and like, yeah, there's Better Off Dead. Oh my God. I feel ashamed. I am ashamed of myself.
Well, you have more Cusack goodness waiting for you.
Excellent. Yes. All right. So, you know what? Now's the time in the podcast where we have to score this against our other Christmas films. So, let's head on over to the Crankometer, which is our patented XY axis for rating Christmas holiday madness. The X axis, we talk about how Christmassy the film is versus the Y axis, which is the quality quotient. Mr. Duraldi, X axis, how would you rate this film Christmasosity?
You know, I'd say maybe like a 0.5 just for the words being uttered and that snippet of the Christmas song that we get and the Tahitian Christmas party. But yeah, it's pretty spare.
Yeah, I would give it a good solid like 1 point. Like that Christmas song sequence earns itself 1 point all by itself. Fair enough.
Yeah, all around up to one.
So yeah, only just barely is this a Christmas film.
But again, like I always say, at least it doesn't completely Christmas shoes it up. So I have to at least give it that.
Right. It doesn't do Christmas wrong, basically.
Exactly.
And then on our y-axis, the quality quotient, gentlemen, how good is this film?
How high do we go on this?
We up to five.
Ah.
Five being, you know, your diehards and your Pee-wee's Christmas at Pee-wee's Playhouses.
Gotcha. I'll go four. I think this is a movie that really holds up. It is a charming romantic comedy in an era where we don't have enough of them.
I'm willing to agree. Yeah, I would definitely not call this one of the greatest films ever made, well, like the DVD says. But you know, it is a quality feature film. I enjoyed it. I had some very unexpected laughs in it, and I would definitely watch this again. So yeah, I would give it a four. John.
I'm happy with that. Yeah, like, I'm trying to think about it, like, what I think of anything negative about it. There are some things that feel kind of cliche about it, but at the time it came out, I would say it's kind of like you can't really knock Die Hard for being cliche because Die Hard established the cliches.
Right.
Exactly. A lot of things about this weren't necessarily trite at the time when it came out. Like, you know, like I said, there are some things that kind of happen because it's a road trip romantic comedy movie, but, mm-hmm. you know, I'll still give it a four because it plays it well. It doesn't actively annoy me at any point.
That's fair.
There's a lot to be said for that.
Absolutely. I think if we can knock it for anything, it might be this film almost feels like it's in too much of a hurry. Like it really speeds through that 95 minutes. But I don't think it wastes any of it.
Yeah. The only scene that really sticks out to me is something that could have been done way better, like very specifically. Because mm-hmm. like I said before, they could use a little more Christmassy nonsense, you know, just every once in a while. But the one kind of really weird gross scene that has to happen in a movie to make the female character like the male character. Oh, I did find something to complain about. Never mind. The scene where she hitchhikes with a random dude and the random dude drives about half a mile and just parks is like, yeah, we're gonna fuck now, which is I'm glad that scene just kind of passes over and they don't really like play too much of it. Because have you guys read the book The Bourne Identity?
No.
So in the book, Franca Potente's character is actually a Canadian woman. Okay. And she kind of like basically falls in love with Jason Bourne because he stops some guy from raping her.
Ooh.
And there's a reason that scene's not in the fucking movie. Beyond the fact that the book is about them basically trying to catch the jackal and it's so dated that there's no way they could do anything with it. But yeah, anyway, that basically...
I mean, I hear you. I think that scene kind of operates in a couple of different ways in terms of, you know, it shows that he, in the same way that she passes on getting on the bus to stay with him, he hops on the back of the truck surreptitiously to keep an eye on her.
Yeah.
Right.
And when it's over, he says, "Are you okay?" And she says, "Yeah." And then he says a second time, "Are you okay?" And she says, "Yeah." And it's like, that felt to me like a moment of genuine sort of understanding and tenderness from him, and it's like, okay, this guy isn't just the belching cheese puff guy. Like, he actually is a sensitive soul under all that.
Right. It's a scene that shows that he does actually have a heart. So yeah, I that's another good scene too. Like,
yeah, like the one thing I was gonna say is what I would change is his crazy act just seems it's just still a bit too smug, John Cusack-y. He doesn't come off as crazy enough. Like, he really needs to like, you know, go for the lights and just chew the fuck out of the scenery, basically. And he doesn't quite do it.
I will say, as somebody who saw this movie when I was like 18 or 19, my friends and I did quote, "someone who would tear your heart out and eat it for pleasure," for years after that.
That is a great, great line. While we're talking about like Cusack doing like awful, like character, not awful as in bad character work, but just like putting on these awful, phony kind of characters. The scene where he is talking to Allison on the rooftop and he gives her the sincerity speech that his roommate tries to like help him out with. He does it in a very obvious, like, William Shatner impression, and it makes me uncomfortable. Like, you know, there's, I've never been able to talk to anyone else quite like you. It's like, well, dude, what are you doing?
It's hard for an actor to play an actor, you know, or like for an actor to let you see them acting. And sometimes they have to tilt into really obvious, like, here I am reading a dialogue that I don't, that not only do I not believe in, my character doesn't believe it either.
Yeah, it's right. Like, it's kind of like one of the hardest things to do is to get like a good piano player to play badly. Like, you can't just make them do it. You have to show them how to play badly.
Right. Exactly. But, you know, and you have to be a really good singer to play a terrible singer. Like, you know, Meryl Streep and Florence Foster Jenkins. Like, you have to be somebody who actually knows how to sing to then be able to know how to do it badly in a way that communicates bad singing and not just is bad singing, you know.
So bad acting is like jazz. It's all about the notes you don't play right.
Exactly.
Oh, very good. But no, like, that scene, it really feels like he's doing an honest to God Shatner impersonation. Like, this is what he thinks quote unquote sincerity sounds like.
Right. And I love how it's just out of nowhere. He's just like, okay, time for the pickup line.
It's like, oh yeah. All he has to do is just say the words in his head. Right. And instead he goes, I'm going to play an actor. Like, no.
Well, he's 18. He's kind of a dipshit and he panics, you know? And so he can't come up with anything else to say. So he goes to the speech and he knows the speech is ridiculous.
Right.
So he barely can even knows how to present it. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I kind of bought the moment for the character. Because he's like floundering.
He gives the sincerity speech insincerely, which is kind of the point.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, but the scene feels real. It just feels super cringy.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's what it is. Yes. That's really what it is. All right. So we've scored the sure thing on our crankometer, a positive 1, positive 4. A little bit Christmassy, but very good film. We encourage you to check it out. I don't know if it's streaming anywhere right now, but it is on DVD and Blu-ray. Definitely give this one a look if you come across it anywhere. So I think that's gonna do it for this episode of Christmas Creeps. We really knocked this one out in a hurry, but you know, this is good. This film is good stuff.
I mean, I can talk about video games for 20 minutes if you want.
I'd rather you didn't.
All right,
but it sounds like you want to, so I'm willing to entertain it.
I'll be over here having a glass of milk or something.
No, I'd rather play video games than talk about them. So
all right. Well, in that case, let's definitely wrap things up here. So, Mr. Giraldi, we really appreciate you coming on the show. We had a great time with you.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Where can our listeners find you on the internet, sir? We know you've got lots of irons in the fire. So.
Far too many places. I write reviews for a website called The Wrap. Mm-hmm. It's at thewrap.com. I co-host a podcast called Linoleum Knife with my husband, Dave White, and also co-host Who Shot Ya on the Maximum Fun Network. And I also co-host a YouTube show called What the Flick over on the Young Turks Network. And I'm at A Duraldi, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E on Twitter, where I probably talk about Hallmark movies more than I should.
Yeah, that's one thing that we kind of don't want to ever sort of dip our toe into is the Hallmark movies, because we know that ocean is deep. And
down that path madness lies. There's none of that in my book, but I've been sort of turned on to them in the years since. And, you know, it's as Dave says that, you know, I made the mistake of doing this book. And so, like, I've seen all the really good ones now. And so, you know, if I can't get my Christmas heroine, I have to settle for the methadone that the Hallmark Channel offers.
Yeah. And also, like, we know there are other podcasts out there that are dedicated to that. And we're just going to let them have it.
Fair enough. I think you don't want turf wars. That gets on.
No, no turf wars. And also, if they genuinely enjoy it and they're happy doing it, then you know what? They can have it. That's okay.
I will say, we totally have dibs on the terrible Netflix imitations of Hallmark movies, though.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, yeah. One of the things I laughed at the most this year was one of your guests having the idea that there should be a Westworld that is Hallmark movie themed. So women could go to like a snowy town in Vermont and have like, you know, chaste romance with a hunky male robot.
I would legitimately love to see that spin on it. It would be great. It would be great television.
It writes itself, people.
It really does. It really does. So anybody listening out there, here's a $1 million idea. Have it. Have at it.
On a platter for
absolutely.
You.
All right. So Mr. Alonzo Giraldi, thank you for joining us. You're welcome back anytime you'd like.
Oh, don't say that, because I'll be hosting another show.
Well,
but have me back whenever you like. I would love
absolutely
to do it.
Will do. So if you enjoyed this episode and you want to comment on it, you can get at us a couple different ways. You can tweet on Twitter. You can tweet at us at Christmas Creeps. You can email us at xmascreeps@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/Christmas Creeps. We're on iTunes and Stitcher and all of those podcast platforms. We're on YouTube now, so definitely check that out and subscribe and do all that fun stuff. And please, if you like the show, leave a star rating and a review. That lets other people know this is a show worth listening to, and we would love to have some more viewers as we get into the legitimate Christmas season. Christmas Creep is real, people, and the Halloween stuff is in the stores now. So definitely come back for that, because we are gearing up for another holiday season. So my name is Joseph Wade. This has been Christmas Creeps. Johnny Five, any parting words?
Bye.
Good night, everybody.
Happy Christmas. Happy Christmas.